Welcome to the deep dive. So today we've got something pretty interesting on the table. Not just one book, but this whole campaign, this plan for a multi-generational fantasy saga.
That's right. It's called the Stone Literary Universe. And yeah, we're looking at the summary for the first book, Hand of Belenos, but also the whole roadmap. Five books planned out.
Five books. Wow. And the core idea is ancient Highland magic meeting, like modern American life. Sounds like a clash.
A definite clash. So our mission today really is to sort of quickly map out the main story conflicts, get a handle on the key players, the themes, and also this really unique structure they have for reader involvement. It's quite something.
Okay, let's start with the hook then. The sources point to this kid, Duncan Graham. He's just a regular boy in suburbia, but he's got this inherited gift from his Scottish ancestors.
Exactly. And it gets, let's say, violently awakened after a tragedy, which immediately brings up that big question the material poses. Is this thing a blessing or is it, you know, a curse?
Right. A blessing or a curse, or maybe both.
Well, it seems like a curse wrapped in a blessing, perhaps, because the sources are clear. Using this power, or even just having it, comes with a cost. Right away, no negotiation.
So he's got this power he doesn't understand in a world that definitely won't understand it.
Precisely. And the gift itself, it's ancient. It's tied to the Graham name, sure, but it goes way back, centuries back in the Highlands, to something they call the lore of the land.
Lore of the land. Okay, that sounds pretty fundamental. Like, it's tied to the place itself, not just him.
That's the implication. It's not just a personal superpower he can switch on and off. It's got weight, history, and dropping that onto a suburban teenager dealing with grief, that's where the conflict sparks.
So it's less about fighting monsters initially and more about internal struggle.
Exactly. The core problem isn't some big bad guy right off the bat. It's control. Can Duncan master this thing? Or is this ancient weight, this gift, going to master him? The sources really hammer this point. Use it or refuse it, the cost could shatter everything he holds dear.
Oof. So inaction isn't safe either.
Apparently not. Survival seems to hinge less on having power and more on maybe acceptance, understanding the rules.
And speaking of understanding, you mentioned his journey takes him somewhere else, a place where the gift is normal.
Yeah, eventually. The summary says he travels to a place where the gift is accepted, revered, and has a legacy of its own, which suggests that, yeah, context is key. Maybe understanding comes from being where it belongs.
That makes sense. It grounds the fantasy a bit.
It seems so. And look, the Kirkus Review, which, you know, carries weight, they called the story intriguing, praised Duncan as totally believable. And this is the key part. They said he succeeds despite getting a life-saving power with no owner's manual.
No owner's manual. Yeah, that sums it up. So the emotional core feels solid, even with the big magic system.
Right. It suggests they've balanced the lore with real human struggle.
Okay, so if Duncan and the gift are the center, who else gets caught in the fallout? The supporting characters must be pretty important here.
Absolutely crucial. His best friend Timmy is presented as this huge emotional anchor, deep loyalty there. And the summary warns that their friendship gets tested in ways neither of them could imagine once the gift comes into play.
And there's that excerpt.
Yeah.
Wow. It really hits hard, showing Timmy's vulnerability. It talks about his days were growing shorter, his mom Blair just collapsing in grief.
Yes, sobbing until every fiber within her ached. It's intense.
But the detail that got me was Timmy, who couldn't see her, still heard her pain, tears on his own face. That connection. It really sets the stakes, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's not just about magic powers.
Not at all. It grounds everything in real, raw emotion. And then you have the female characters adding layers of complexity. Sarah, for instance. She's carrying trauma, emotionally guarded, drawn to Duncan, but maybe dangerously so.
And then Hannah, who's described as the opposite, like the light.
Sort of, yeah. Warm, sassy, down to earth. And interestingly, she's drawn to Sarah, seeing maybe a shared background, potential for healing. They both had tough upbringings, it seems.
There's that little moment in the source material, the flashback, where Hannah's West Virginia accent makes Sarah freeze up.
Right, because it's too familiar. It's an accent Sarah herself buried ages ago. That little detail speaks volumes about shared pasts, hidden identities. Their connection isn't superficial.
Okay, so you have friendship drama, potential romance drama.
Yeah.
What about family? Duncan's mother, McKenna.
McKenna. She's the Scottish connection. Fierce, loving, but she apparently knows things about the gift, about the clan, that even she doesn't fully grasp, and her past. Huge secrets there. Specifically, a forbidden love.
The one that resulted in Duncan.
That's what the material confirms. And it's not just backstory. It's the main focus of the sequel, Stone of Elisanos.
Which brings in Alan, right? The nephew from Scotland.
Yes.
His arrival must stir things up.
You bet. If Duncan is the product of this forbidden love, Alan showing up immediately raises flags. Does he carry that old clan bitterness, the Drummond Graham feud? That's a big question mark hanging over him.
So these ancient clan issues, they actually reach into modern suburbia. It's not just backstory.
Seems not. The sources frame it as ancestral debts, old rivalries demanding a reckoning, even now. Which actually leads us nicely into the whole scope of this thing. It's bigger than just Duncan's story.
Yeah, the 5-book plan, it's ambitious. How does it all connect? It's not just sequel after sequel, is it?
No, it's structured quite deliberately. The narrative actually moves backward in time.
Backward. Okay, explain that.
So, book one, Hand of Belenos, is Duncan, present day. Book two, Stone of Elisanos, which is slated for late 2026, focuses on someone named Ethan. Then book three, Danu of Talam, planned for late 2027, jumps way back to Dugald.
Dugald, one of the early ones. Like ancient history bearers of the Geat.
Exactly, one of the earliest known bearers. And this structure is clever because each trip back reveals more about the Geat's origins, the lore, the rules, which then makes you rethink everything Duncan is going through in book one.
Okay, so the past constantly recontextualizes the present.
Precisely. And we get a glimpse of those ancient rules through Dugald. He experiences this pull from the gift and recalls the law, something like,
do not ignore the pull when it calls to you. Yeah, I saw that. Answer the pull at a slight cost to you.
Do not answer the pull begets a greater cost to all. That right there. That seems to be the fundamental rule of this universe.
Wow. Okay, so it's not optional. The gift demands you act.
It seems so. It's not a power you can just choose to use sometimes. Ignoring it has consequences, potentially catastrophic ones for everyone. It frames the whole idea of choice in a really interesting way.
If inaction costs more, is it really a choice? Heavy stuff.
Definitely. And that theme of consequence seems to expand outward in the final two books, Sacred or Secret and Cloaked Content, planned for late 2028, 2029. They're described as ripples spreading from Duncan's story.
Ripples that go where?
Well, book five is described as an intentional departure. The gift goes where it's needed most, apparently, and the example given is, even if that means the White House.
Whoa. Okay. From suburban tragedy and Highland lore to the White House, that's quite a jump in scale.
It is. It suggests the ultimate purpose of this gift, this lore, is much bigger than just family secrets or clan fights. It's potentially world-shaping.
Right. Okay, this brings us to something else that's really unusual here, how they're involving the readers. You mentioned the structure was unique.
Yeah, the creator specifically used a crowdfunding platform, not just for funding, but because the story itself is about participation, about being present, answering the call. So the way they engage the community actually mirrors the book's theme.
How so? What kind of participation are we talking about?
It goes way beyond just buying the book. Some of the tiers are designed for deep engagement, like the scribe tier. Backers track the emotions each chapter makes them feel and post it on this wall of Belenos. So reader feeling becomes part of the collective experience.
Huh. Interesting. Making subjective response public. What else?
Well, you can become part of the lore's structure. The Sacral Council member tier gets you a certificate, like on canvas, rolled like a scroll. Pretty cool. But it also grants VIP access, input in roundtables, essentially making you part of the universe's governing body in a meta way.
Okay, that's involved.
Yeah.
But then there's actually getting written into the story.
Yes. That's the big one. The Legend and Dark Warriors tiers. People can literally have characters based on them with dialogue and subplots written into the historical prequel book.
Seriously. So you could be a good guy or a bad guy in ancient Scotland.
Pretty much. The Dark Warriors track, there were 5 slots, puts you in as one of the corrupt Drummond clansmen, led by this antagonist, Oswan Drummond, actively working against the heroes in Book 2, Stone of Elisanos. And you have to accept the negative consequences in the story.
Wow. Okay, so you choose to be evil, you get treated as evil in the book. Bold.
Right. And conversely, the Legend track, 10 slots for that one, lets you be written in as a supporter, a clan chief, or maybe a figure of lore like a master blacksmith or a skilled seafarer, appearing in book 3, Danu of Talam, helping shape the history of the 10 clans featured there.
So readers aren't just consuming the history. They're literally becoming part of the ancient history that Duncan eventually inherits the consequences of.
Mm.
That's a really intricate loop.
It is. It turns reading into a form of active participation, even historical contribution within the fiction.
And there were even more exclusive things, right? Like super limited items.
Oh, yeah. The venerated tier, just 25 spots, included a personal cinema device preloaded with exclusive video content, and then the ultimate one-off. The CODIS Prime honor.
CODIS Prime, what's that?
That person holds the literal number one copy, the very first signed, numbered, embossed, printed book of the entire series. They become like the official historical artifact for the whole project.
That's intense. So, okay, let's try and wrap this up. We've unpacked a really complex narrative here. It weaves together what? Ancestral legacy, hidden parentage, emotional trauma, this powerful, costly gift. All spanning centuries.
Right, and all tied together by this structure that demands reader participation, mirroring the gift's own demands within the story.
So if we had to boil down the core conflict, the central ethical dilemma for you, the listener, it comes back to that ancient law, doesn't it?
It really does. Answer the poll at a slight cost to you. Do not answer the poll begets a greater cost to all. The story seems fundamentally built on the weight of individual choice and the idea that inaction might be the most dangerous choice of all.
Which leaves us with a pretty potent thought, I think. If you inherit this legacy, this gift, that demands a price for using it, but an even greater price for not using it. What does that really say about destiny versus choice? Is the hardest part just constantly calculating the cost? Figuring out which price is worth paying, definitely something to chew on.